Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. has the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world. That is, the highest number of women dying during pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum. And 60% of those deaths are preventable. NPR and ProPublica, in a jointly published investigation, recently started tracking the number of pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S. and estimate that number between 700 and 900 in 2016. Joining us by phone is ProPublica reporter Nina Martin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It wasn't easy, or it isn't easy, to figure out that number, is it?
No, it's actually quite difficult. The states don't do a very good or consistent job of tracking maternal deaths. It's up to each state. Some do a great job, some don't do it at all. The federal government is dependent on state data and then also hasn't been able to muster the will to come up with a different system that allows maternal deaths, that requires maternal deaths to be counted more consistently. So it's sort of the actual number or the fact that there isn't an actual number hasn't been come up with, has been called an international embarrassment.
You highlighted 120 of the stories out of that 600 or 700. How did you find those?
Well, we started looking for maternal deaths last fall. I started looking, and I noticed that they were really hard to find. And so that really, you know, is always intriguing. Why mm-hmm. is something that is such a huge event in the lives, not just of individual families, but of often entire communities. Why is it not? Why are they hidden? Why can't we find them? Why mm-hmm. don't researchers know who these women are and so forth? And part of the problem is that, you know, maternal deaths are not in the news. They're not usually they're not mentioned in obituaries. But we do have a new tools that we didn't have just a couple years ago. One are crowdfunding sites and Facebook, so and social media sites. So that's what we started doing. We started looking at GoFundMe and, to a lesser extent, YouCaring, for memorials to mothers who had died or women who had died, and then supplemented it with searches on Facebook, public Facebook posts. And then once we found names, sometimes it was only a name, sometimes it was only a partial name, we then dug deeper to try to find out who that person was and then to track down an obituary and other information confirming that she had indeed died and that her death was related to pregnancy or childbirth causes.
26 American women die for every 100,000 live births in the United States. Mm-hmm. How does that stack up to other developed countries?
Other developed countries have much lower rates of maternal death. The U.S. rate is more than twice that of the U.K. It is, I think I have that somewhere like more than three times that of Canada, more than, you know, five or six times that of the Scandinavian countries. Admittedly, the U.S. is of different is very different mm-hmm. Demographically from, say, Sweden or Denmark, which are much more homogenous. Probably a better comparison is the UK, which is becoming increasingly diverse. But you know, we have our rate is it more than twice as high as, you know, a place like the UK.
You often hear people crowing about how the United States has a better healthcare system. Is this, which of course, you know, anyone who studies it knows that's not the case.
Right.
This is one of those statistics that people look at, right?
It is one of those statistics that people look at. The U.S. has, you know, generally, certainly a better healthcare system than many countries in the world. It is certainly for women who have access to good healthcare, who have access to decent insurance. They have access to a level of technological healthcare, you know, x-rays and ultrasounds and surgeries and so forth that many women in other certainly developing countries lack. What the U.S. doesn't have is a healthcare system that is fully integrated. There's everybody, even people who have good insurance, have a series of providers and you know, things switch when their insurance switches, and they have greater, less access over, you know, at certain times of their lives than others. And so what there is not great continuum of care. For women on public insurance, that's even more so, obviously, because they don't have access, for the most part, except in Medicaid expansion states. But under traditional Medicaid, they don't have access to health care until they're pregnant. So in all those issues that develop in the period before you actually get pregnant can become, you know, really important conditions, and they're difficult to treat and make pregnancy more complicated. And then those women don't have access to insurance. They only have their access to Medicaid for about 2 months after they give birth. And so anything that happens in the postpartum period is very often left untreated.
Yeah, when we're looking at that 26 out of every 100,000, how much of is that postpartum related?
You know, that's a good question. I would say, based on individual studies that I've seen, it's at least half. And so it's depending on where you start counting postpartum, it could be a good amount more than that. Some people would say postpartum is immediately, you know, it's right after you give birth. Other people would say it's after you leave the hospital. So let's say it's kind of after, you know, it's certainly fair to say that it's more than 50%.
Age is an issue. Women in the United States tend to have children later in life.
Yes.
And that raises the risk.
Well, the age of maternal age is definitely rising. You'll notice in the picture in the story that we had this week, a number of those women were in their late 30s. That was sort of an accident of who was willing to talk to us, and we spotlighted. However, when you are older, you come in with more pre-existing conditions. So you're more likely to have a heart condition or diabetes or some other, you know, obesity, some other chronic condition that makes pregnancy more complicated. But it's actually really important to understand a couple of things. Mm-hmm. First of all, that none of the women that we spotlighted in our story died of old, you know, of because they were older.
Yeah.
They died because their symptoms were ignored. And sometimes it's really easy for, while there may be a greater tendency for women to have complicated pregnancies when they're a little bit older, it does not mean that they are dying because they are older. It's because other things are still going untreated or unnoticed or misdiagnosed. And the other thing that's important to note is that the maternal death rate has been rising in other industrialized countries, and their death rates have not been going up. So, I mean, the birth rate, I should say,
gotcha.
Age at birth, so of the mother. So, you know, UK, France, basically all of Europe and most of the industrialized world, same thing is happening. So it's not about the maternal age. It's about something else.
Right. I mean, that's another point. I'm not sure I made the distinction, but the rate is going up in the United States. It's not going down, which was really surprising.
Right. It has been going up over a period of time in the U.S. And it has been going down in other countries. That's exactly right. And that is surprising to a lot of people. You know, some of that may be sort of statistical garbage kind of in the background, mm-hmm. Making some numbers difficult to make it, you know, there's a certain amount of statistical question mark there. But mostly it's really not. I think that one of the big issues in the U.S. is that paradoxically, you know, doctors and women and hospitals, providers have really come to see maternal death as a non-issue, as something that is very rare and that they don't really have to worry about. And they may never encounter anyone who died in their hospital, in their practice, in their own circles. And so there's this idea that pregnancy and childbirth are safe, and so we don't really have to worry about that so much from the perspective of the mom. Let's really worry about the babies. And so by not understanding that these events, deaths, but especially near deaths, are much more common than people realize, there's this complacency that's kind of been created in the system. And then when something does happen, very often doctors and hospitals and women themselves and families themselves don't know what's going on. They don't know how to respond. And something ends up being, you know, the event turns much more serious or life-threatening or deadly than it might otherwise need to be. And, you know, the system, again, because our healthcare system is not fully integrated, the healthcare system is often, the providers often aren't able to track women either, and that becomes another problem.
Infections are a problem, and that's something that I think that was the Laura Bloomstein story was, or Bloomstein, in others of the stories, they got infections in the hospitals.
Well, yes. So infections in hospitals are a problem. They're a problem in all kinds of surgery and all kinds of settings. And once again, I think that there's a tendency in the maternal area not to see infections as being as serious as they are, say, in the cardiac area or if somebody comes in for knee surgery or something. And part of the problem is that women are one of the issues. It's not a problem, is that women come in usually when they give birth, they actually come in very good health. Even a woman who has, you know, chronic diabetes or a woman who has chronic hypertension, somebody who is has other pre-existing conditions, is generally much healthier than somebody who comes in to the hospital for cardiac surgery. And so what ends up happening is that there are no, you know, there's still infections. There's still actually infections kill, I don't have the number exactly in front of me, but I think it's about somewhere in the range of 10% of maternal deaths are infection related. But infections are just sort of not sort of, there aren't protocols in place in a lot of hospital settings to deal with infection because they're just not, again, necessarily thought to be as common as they are. In other settings in the hospital, in the cardiac unit, in the, you know, knee surgery unit, whatever, infections are understood to be quite common, and so there are a lot of protocols in place to recognize who might be at risk and to go immediately into crisis mode when somebody develops some of the signs of infection.
Hormones play a role in many of these cases. Some trigger heart conditions. Others are related to postpartum mental illness.
Yes.
That was really interesting to me. It's something I was not aware of.
Yes. So to sort of step back, I think one of the things that's really important about pregnancy and childbirth is to understand what a huge stress they put on a person's body. These are normal changes, of course, but there's, if you think about sort of the amount of stuff that happens in your body, a woman's body when she becomes pregnant and then when she gives birth and then when in the postpartum period when she recovers, it's mind-boggling. And a lot of it has to do with hormones. A lot of it, that, you know, there's the creation of an entirely new organ, the placenta, that then is, you know, exists and then goes away after the birth. There's the blood volume in a woman's body is suddenly increased enormously, and there's, you know, her heart is working much harder and everything. And so all of these things together can create changes in a woman's body or strains on a woman's body that become that can be dangerous for some people, for people with pre-existing conditions, but often for people who don't have pre-existing conditions. That's the thing, is cardiomyopathy, peripartum cardiomyopathy, which is pregnancy-induced heart failure, is surprisingly common. Again, it counts for 11% of maternal deaths and many near misses. It's been thought to be, you know, really rare. We haven't looked for these conditions until recently because, again, coming back to the whole point of this story, we don't know who these women are. Mm. We don't study them. We don't track their deaths. We don't, you know, the delays in the states that do track deaths, the delays in analyzing data are often, you know, years long. And so it takes a really long time to see what's going on, to understand what the underlying events are, and then to kind of make medical and policy change to improve the system for women and families.
And where you live is another issue. People who live in impoverished areas or rural areas are more at risk.
Yes. So people who live in rural areas are particularly at risk because there just are fewer facilities in rural counties that deliver babies and that are able to go into crisis mode if something happens. Urban areas can be problematic in different ways. The hospitals are often very over, you know, they're kind of baby delivery mills, and they have very often really good at trauma. But again, women going into coming in childbirth are not seen as being ill. They're not necessarily treated in the same way that, for lots of very good reasons, that somebody coming in that's, you know, got a gunshot or something. Mm-hmm. So it does actually make quite a difference. One thing I want to make a point about for people is, or a couple of things. One is that one of the responses that we've gotten is people being kind of, you know, telling us, oh my God, I had no idea this is happening. I'm pregnant. How can this not happen to me? And the idea is not to stress people out, to freak them out about with stories about maternal deaths or near deaths. It's really to kind of, you know, help people understand who these women are, and their stories, and to create a sense of awareness, and that maybe not hypervigilance, but greater vigilance, both on the in the parts of women and families, and also their doctors and providers, to understand that, no, wait a second, these things actually do happen. Maternal deaths are rare, but they happen, and you should, you know, be aware that they happen, and not pretend that they don't exist. The things that are much more common are near deaths, women who have life-threatening complications that are require massive technological intervention, huge, they maybe end up in ICU, they may end up having, you know, large transfusions or organ failure, something like that. Those are a lot more common than people realize, and those are also really life-changing events. They can be. There are 65,000 of those a year, according to the CDC, and that's really where people need to be focused, I think, a lot. Maternal deaths are the ones that we didn't save. The ones that we did save, these 65,000 women a year, are still really severely injured, and their care the ways that they're being injured are important to study and understand and to protect against.
Nina Martin, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Nina Martin is a ProPublica reporter. She worked jointly with NPR and ProPublica in a jointly published investigation, which recently started tracking the number of pregnancy-related deaths in the United States, and estimate that number between 700 and 900 in 2016. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the United States, anorexia has the highest fatality rate of any mental illness, including depression. The recently released Netflix movie entitled To the Bone was produced in part to shed light on that complex issue. The movie is based on the life of the producer who had an eating disorder. It tells the story of 20-year-old Ellen, played by actress Lily Collins, who is entering her fifth eating disorder treatment center. In this scene, she counts calories for her sister, played by Liana Liberato.
All right, ready? 280 for the pork, 350 for the buttered noodles, 150 for the roll, and 75 for butter.
It's like you have calorie Asperger's.
Hmm. The film has stirred the pot. Some say the story glamorizes anorexia. Others say it's a frank portrayal. Joining us to talk about it, Chief Clinical Officer at the Center for Balanced Living in Columbus, Jason McCray. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Ed.
And by phone, Ohio State psychologist who specializes in eating disorders and sports, Jen Carter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Just want to tell our listeners, if you or someone you know is suffering from an eating disorder, call the National Eating Disorder Association hotline at 1-800-931-2237. We'll also have a link to the Center for Balanced Living in Columbus if you want to check that out. Many of those reacting to the film's trailer worried that watching it could trigger unhealthy thoughts in viewers who may be prone to eating disorders or already struggling with them. Is this a movie they should avoid, Jen Carter?
I don't think so. I think it has some hits and misses, and I do not see it as glamorizing eating disorders. I thought that there were some problems with the accuracy of treatment that I could get into, but I don't think that they need to avoid it.
The life of then, it wasn't a glamorization, you think. Jason McCray, what were your thoughts?
You know, I'd agree with Dr. Carter that it doesn't really glamorize it in any way. It shows some of the frank realities in a way that are stark and that ought to give people pause. And I think it might be helpful in starting a conversation about how serious these disorders are and how disruptive they are to people's lives.
Could it be a trigger, though, for somebody who's teetering?
It absolutely could. And if somebody has an eating disorder or is at risk for eating disorder, this could be something that would be triggering. However, there are really profound communities or very large communities online that have all this information already out there. So, you know, for folks who are curious, they're going to find the information. So it seems unlikely to me that folks are going to hear about binging or purging or restricting for the first time by watching a movie on Netflix.
You know, it's always with something like this. I mean, there's this character and she's played by Lily Collins. There must be a myriad characters out there, stories out there. Could one story do justice anyways, Jen Carter?
Well, we know that the most common eating disorder is binge eating disorder, followed by bulimia nervosa, followed by anorexia nervosa. So anorexia nervosa is the most deadly but least common. I look at this movie more like art in that you cannot represent everybody's story. It's trying to show one story. And there were a variety of eating disorders in terms of the clients who were present at the residential facility. So we did get to see other eating or disorders beyond anorexia nervosa.
So anorexia nervosa, it's categorized as a mental illness. Lots of times people want to talk about the psychology of it. That's certainly something that's emphasized in the film. Jason McCray, I've talked with folks from your shop before that there's a lot of fantastic evidence and research out there now that shows it's a brain chemistry issue, just like depression is.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. Starting in about 2006, there's been a line of research that has identified a number of different brain sites that dysfunction and some neurochemical differences in folks who develop these disorders versus the general population. So since about 2009, the Academy for Eating Disorders, which is the premier professional group in the eating disorder community, has had a position statement that eating disorders are serious neurobiologically caused mental illnesses and need to be treated as such.
And Jen Carter, your thoughts as a psychologist?
Well, I absolutely agree. And I formerly worked at the Center for Balanced Living as well, so benefited from the research being done there. And that was my biggest problem with the film, is not paying attention to these neurobiological realities. At one point, the therapist is saying, "Eat what you want." And that horrified me because the client could do that outside in her home. And she was doing that. And she really needed help to push through the intense anxiety and distress she experiences when she eats due to these neurobiological abnormalities.
So if it's a neurobiological abnormality and that's been shown, is it treated with both then, chemicals and talk therapy, just like a lot of depression is treated, Jen Carter?
Well, we know for eating disorders, the best medication is food and really trying to help the individual establish normal eating.
Okay.
Medications can be a helpful addition, especially for comorbid conditions like anxiety and depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jason McCray?
Yeah, I'd agree with Dr. Carter that the first round of medication is really food. And what we see, particularly in folks who have anorexia, but to a lesser extent with bulimia and binge eating disorder, is that the side effect of having that food, their body kind of metabolizing food and what that does to their brain chemistry, results in enormous amounts of anxiety. And so some medications can be helpful in attenuating that anxiety and making that a little more manageable. But really, the bottom line in eating disorder treatment is that you've got to eat enough food to put you into a metabolically appropriate state and not do anything to make up for it. And all of the talk therapy that we do is around helping people to have skills to cope with just how difficult that is to do.
In terms of making a film like this, there's always conversations about actors who gain or lose a lot of weight for a film. There's some very notable examples out there. Lily Collins, who plays the main character, lost a lot of weight for the film. Probably not a lot, maybe a lot to me. But she has had her own struggles with eating disorders in the past. And I guess it gets back to the question of a trigger. Jen Carter, what did you think about that, that Lily Collins had risked her life probably to do this?
Right. Well, and Dr. McRae has an excellent YouTube video about the views that we all have. Some are shorter, some are longer in terms of the risk factors when we lose weight. Most of us, if we go on diets, we'll lose weight, gain the weight back, and not be any different for it. But some people, that weight loss sets off an addictive process in the eating disorder. And so if she has a history of anorexia nervosa and she's losing weight, that sounds rather dangerous to me. And I'm really hopeful that she's been able to restore weight since this movie.
Even though there's been well established now the neurobiological link to all of this, there was a stereotype for a long time, Jason McRae, that people with particularly anorexia nervosa or bulimia were control freaks. They were type A personalities. Is there any connection there at all?
You know, it's very rare that families play any significant role in helping to start an eating disorder. 50 to 80% of the variance in who develops an eating disorder and who doesn't is genetic. So for anorexia and bulimia, that puts it in roughly the same ballpark as how tall you are or what your IQ is. And so these are enormously hereditable conditions, and the risk for them is very hereditable.
It's not about behavior, not about somebody showing you how to do it.
No, not really. What it is folks who are at higher genetic risk, their body's more sensitive to when they enter even very mild states of being malnourished. So going on the same kind of diet that a lot of other folks might go on, and it goes perfectly fine for them, but their bodies and their brains react to even relatively mild states of being malnourished. Or if somebody continues eating in a reasonable way, but they begin to exercise a little bit more, maybe because it's cross-country season or the soccer team's running a lot. And so that energy in and energy out balance gets imbalanced. Folks who have that genetic risk are much more sensitive to that. And then once the brain responds to that, it's really off to the races from there.
Hmm. Jen Carter, what are your thoughts about that, this thinspo or thin inspiration posts on Instagram and social media? That's really getting to be a thing.
Right. Well, there were some questions about, you know, this movie being triggering. And I believe life is triggering, unfortunately. Yeah. There are all sorts of messages out there that make it hard for us to accept and celebrate our bodies as is. And there are some communities that are celebrating the illness, you know, and increasing that within themselves. And, you know, it really depends on the stage of recovery of the individual and his or her coping skills in terms of how they might view a movie like this or thinspiration sites, whether it's, you know, that's not where I need to be, and or, you know, getting ideas for how to be more ill.
You criticized to the bone over the lack of meal plans and also the lack of skill training. What about meal plans?
Well, we know that eating disorders are not all about food, and restoring healthy nutrition is an important part of recovery. So we work, the psychologists and mental health professionals work closely with dietitians to help establish what does the body need scientifically, and that varies across individuals, but the dietitians can really create a meal plan that works just right for the individual. And then the psychologists help those individuals follow the meal plan because, as Dr. McRae said, there is all kinds of anxiety by doing that.
So, Jason McRae, what kind of meal plans, for instance, at the Center for Balanced Living? What does that look like?
So what happens is folks will sit down and they'll meet with one of our dietitians, and we'll collect a lot of information about their weight history, their pediatric height weight charts, and what that growth curve looked like. Also, what kind of physical activity folks are doing, any medical conditions that they have. And based off of all of that, combined with their current activity levels, it creates an estimate of what their current energy needs are. And then that total energy need, so usually we would talk calories, but in the eating disorder treatment world, we don't really talk that because that's triggering. It's part of the illness.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is we talk about recommending or prescribing a meal plan that's broken up into three meals and two to three snacks spread out throughout the day. So you eat within an hour of getting up and every 3 to 4 hours throughout the day. And each one of those meals will have a prescribed number of exchanges of carbohydrates, of dietary fats, of protein, and then except for breakfast, also a vegetable. And so when you're meeting the macronutrient exchanges, so carbohydrates, proteins, and dietary fats, that's really going to get you to the proper calorie levels. And it's also going to ensure that your body has the nutritional building blocks it needs to restore itself, to metabolically regulate, and be on the path to wellness.
How long does it take to change the brain when it comes to an eating disorder?
There is enormous variability with that. Some folks can start following a meal plan and within a couple of weeks, they're thinking better and they're feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
For some folks, it takes a year or even two.
Hmm. And then skill training. Jen Carter?
Yeah, there is a variety of skills depending on your theoretical orientation as a therapist. But I know at the Center for Balanced Living, they use dialectical behavior therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, and some other approaches. The idea behind eating disorders is that the purpose of the eating disorder is to numb or avoid emotion. So if you're reducing those eating disorder behaviors, you're going to have a lot of emotion arise. And how are you going to cope with that? Mm. So the skills are designed to teach individuals how to cope with the emotion more effectively.
You also wrote that the movie appears to dismiss the Renfrew and Maudsley approaches to treatment. Is that one of the dialectical treatments that you were talking about?
So Renfrew is a treatment center that is well known, and the Maudsley approach is an approach used for adolescents where the family becomes kind of the in-home therapist. And there was a comment made early in the movie where they were dissing both of Renfrew treatment center and the Maudsley approach when both have great evidence-based outcomes.
Huh. They were dissing it.
Yeah. I think some of the movie was a little bit, I thought they did a good job kind of inserting some humor into a very dark topic. And I think you might see that with individuals in treatment, kind of like, oh, did you see this therapist or try this method? And that sucked, right? Or, you know,
kind of the gallows humor type of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
They can laugh about it, but I can't laugh about it.
Right.
That's the difference. So Jason McCrae, then. Is this a leap forward? Is this a treading water moment in time? What do you think? I mean, would you want people to watch it? Do you want people to learn more about it? Does this get us there?
Well, I think that we're having this conversation, and there are lots
yeah.
of conversations like this happening all over the country this week because this film has started some conversations. And I think that within mental health stigma is a big thing in and of its own right. But particularly with eating disorders, those continue to experience probably more stigma than a lot of other conditions. And so the more that we can pull this out of the shadows and get people talking about it and get people paying attention to it, I think that probably there's going to be some net good from that, whether it's a big step forward or a momentary blip where we talk about it and then we're on to the next thing in a couple of weeks remains to be seen.
Okay. Well, Dr. Jason McCrae, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jason McCrae is the Chief Clinical Officer at the Center for Balanced Living right here in Columbus. And Jen Carter, thanks to you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anne.
Dr. Jen Carter, psychologist at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. She specializes in eating disorders and sports. Remember, if you or someone you know is suffering from an eating disorder, we'll have a link to the Center for Balanced Living on our website at WOSU.org, along with the number for the National Eating Disorder Association hotline at 1-800-931-2237. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Cleveland Clinic is one of the best hospitals in the world. It's the second largest employer in Ohio. It's expanded to cities such as London and Abu Dhabi, attracted wealthy patients from all over the place, and raked in billions of dollars. Yet, its mission is to save lives, the neighborhoods surrounding the clinic's main campus are staying sick. Dan Diamond is a healthcare reporter for Politico. He recently wrote about the disparity between the hospital and the communities surrounding it in an article entitled "How the Cleveland Clinic Grows Healthier While Its Neighbors Stay Sick." We'll have a link to it at WOSU.org/allsides. Dan Diamond joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
This isn't an isolated paradox. There's lots of big cities, particularly around the country, that have this same dynamic. What led you to explore the paradox in and of itself?
Well, it's a story that on some level I've been thinking about my whole life without realizing it or writing about it. I grew up in Baltimore, where Johns Hopkins Hospital, maybe the best hospital in the world, is much like the clinic, in a very economically deprived area. And they never made sense to me when we would drive to the hospital. My dad's a doctor, and Cleveland is another city where that same dynamic has happened, and Pittsburgh and Boston. You can look all over the country. I think what drew me to Cleveland was Cleveland has become a healthcare mecca where manufacturing, construction, old industries have died off. These new industries have come in. And the clinic is world-class. They do a lot of good. But because they are tax-exempt, there are questions about, are they doing enough for their community? Are they putting enough back to help with schools and roads and other things that tax-paying businesses do? And as you pointed out in your intro, they are the second largest employer in Ohio. One of their staffers actually said they're the first largest. So if they're second largest, it's only by a couple hundred jobs. So if they are going to be the economic powerhouse for the state, what responsibility do they have to the community around it? Because that is the deal that they made to be tax exempt, to serve the community.
In your article, you wrote, a doctor on staff could spend years entirely inside this bubble, from parking in an adjacent garage every morning where art prints from artists like Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein hang in the corridors, to eating at the 24-hour Obompain, never setting foot on the sidewalks outside. And that is something that, as you said, your dad is a physician. You had that experience yourself, and he did too.
I think I lived that. I mean, I went to the Cleveland Clinic a couple times over the past few years to do my reporting, and I was there at all hours. I was wandering around the neighborhood pretty late, and the difference is staggering. I stepped off campus and came upon a woman. This is the anecdote that I used to open the story, who had just had a break-in the night before, and she was trying to fix the door on her house, which had been torn off its hinges. And this is maybe 100 meters from the edge of the Cleveland Clinic campus, which is, if your listeners have been there, it's an oasis. It's beautiful. There's grass, there's fountains, there's live music, there are farmers markets. And yet the neighborhood right outside is totally different. And I heard from a lot of staff that not only are they scared to go into the community, they never do. They have no reason to. And the interesting flip is when you go into the community, you hear a similar message from people who have lived around the clinic for years. They're scared of the clinic. So there's probably an underlying tension and fear that doesn't come from a good place. It just comes from a place of an institution and a neighborhood that very awkwardly coexist.
Why are they scared of the clinic? Like, they don't belong there? Because there's a similar dynamic in Columbus between, you know, lifelong multi-generational families in Columbus and the Ohio State campus. They never have gone there before.
You know, that's such a good question. And I went to a school in Philadelphia, which was in West Philadelphia. And that neighborhood, for anyone who listened to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air TV show, West Philadelphia, it wasn't necessarily the best neighborhood, and yet the university kept expanding. There are always going to be tensions between powerful institutions and longtime residents. That's not exclusive to Cleveland. And even if Cleveland Clinic did every single thing right, I'm sure that there would be some jealousies that come from an unfair place. The issue with the clinic specifically is they have bought up land that used to belong to the churches, and those churches burned down or people moved out, and you could argue the clinic is just taking the land that's available. But if you're a resident who's lived there for decades and you see businesses leaving and the clinic expanding and not necessarily hiring you because you're not a doctor or a nurse, mm-hmm. that can create these underlying questions and tensions about whether the hospital really is the best thing for a neighborhood that has gone from over 100,000 people 50 years ago to about 15,000, I think most recently in the census, 18,000 in 2010, but that's gone down since.
Right.
The neighborhood is definitely dying, and that doesn't harm the clinic. If anything, it helps the clinic have more room to keep growing.
The clinic backed a $331 million construction project called the Opportunity Corridor. It's a new 3-mile highway run by the Ohio Department of Transportation. What was that for? What were they shooting for there?
So your listeners may also know this pretty well because I think it's been in the news in Cleveland for several years. But the Ohio Opportunity Corridor, specifically in Cleveland, there are a lot of reasons for it. It can bring people from the suburbs into the nice University Circle area. But I talked to clinic staff and got one on the record basically saying, we're building this in part because of concern that the neighborhood around here is too rough. And this will help our staff and patients who tend to live in the suburbs get to our campus faster. And there was an amazing moment, it was about a year ago, where tensions had reached the point that a councilman stepped in to briefly block the project, and his community came out to talk to him about it. And it was, I've written about healthcare for years and years. This is certainly one of the most tense moments I can ever remember, with members of the community first getting mad at the councilman for saying, was he doing enough to help the community? And then turning their rage on the clinic, who no one from the clinic was really there in the room, but kind of by proxy, people were invoking the clinic and how it had grown and how this corridor, it was called the Opportunity Corridor, but they didn't feel like it was actually going to bring them any opportunities. Mm-hmm. It was just going to bring the clinic more patients and more revenue.
And bypassing the community around it.
Yes, and tearing down parts of the neighborhood that, again, in the clinic's defense, may have been blighted, may not be being put to the best use, but it was a hard sell for people who have lived there for years and years that somehow putting a new road there would bring them the prosperity that has gone away.
I know that Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus has been working really hard to overcome a similar lack of relationship with the community around it and is investing a lot of money and is really also working to hire people in the neighborhood and to get people who work at the hospital to move to the neighborhood, kind of making it more of a, you know, a diverse neighborhood in socioeconomic terms. Is that something other hospitals around the country are? I mean, this isn't an isolated situation. It's common. It sounds like the clinic tried to bypass the neighborhood. It sounds like Nationwide Children's is trying to integrate into the neighborhood better.
I think the clinic would say, and I wanted to have some of this in the piece, mm-hmm. they have supported the neighborhood in some important ways. They've invested in the community center. There are job training programs that they help subsidize. And Toby Cosgrove, the CEO of the clinic, argued to me, this isn't our job at the end of the day to save a neighborhood, to save an economy. We are a hospital. Why should it be on us more than anybody else? Mm-hmm. The counter to that is hospitals are, beyond being tax exempt, the nature of hospital care and healthcare has changed a lot. There is more focus now on what's called population health. So not just the healthcare that you're getting at a hospital or from a doctor, it's that ongoing access to healthy food or housing, so people have a roof over their heads and no lead paint on the walls. And hospitals are increasingly getting paid for doing a good job at that, too. So that's the direction that healthcare is headed. It's not surprising to hear, I don't know Columbus all that well, but that Nationwide is making an investment in its neighborhood, too. I think lots of hospitals are. The ultimate question to me, Anne, mm-hmm. isn't, are hospitals doing this? It's, can they do more? Should they do more? And do they have the resources to do more? And it's hard to wander the campus of the clinic or look at their financial statement where they've cleared $2.7 billion in profit over the past 4 years and wonder, this is a not-for-profit hospital. Would it be better for everyone if not-for-profit hospitals were making as little possible profit as they can and reinvesting every single dollar into community, into healthcare delivery, and so on?
You know, what do you think it looks like when a hospital's doing things right? You mentioned the farmers market. I mean, is that open to people in the community?
It's open to people in the community. They just have no reason to go. And what I mean by that is the prices are high, huh. and the products are lovely and intricate and artisan and not necessarily things that the average family in that community needs. And I made a list of every stand I went to, there were multiple dog food stands. There were honey stands, a wool stand, great things. But if you are looking for a healthy grocery, that's not necessarily where you would go. And everyone I saw browsing there was either a clinic staffer or an occasional patient who's kind of passing through. Mm-hmm. You asked, what does it look like when a hospital is doing this right?
Yeah.
I think the nation's public hospitals, and Nationwide Children's is probably a good example too, the children's hospitals are very community focused. The challenge of the Cleveland Clinic is they have become a national and even international system with locations all over the country. And I asked their CEO this, how do you stay focused on Cleveland when you have all of these other factors now, a campus in England, a campus overseas in the Middle East, Florida, and so on? How do you make sure that this is still your focus? And he said, well, we will never leave the community. Cleveland's in our name. But it certainly is harder to remain focused on your backyard when you have all of those other opportunities out there, too.
And Cleveland is struggling. I mean, there's some real need out there. Like I said, what would it look like, though? I mean, are you talking about what would the outreach be? What do you think?
I think one very easy thing is what's called a payment in lieu of taxes or pilot program. And this has been worked out by hospitals in Boston, in Milwaukee, all over the country, where instead of paying their full tax bill, which in the Cleveland Clinic's case is north of $35 million a year, maybe they pay a fraction of that. They pay a couple million dollars, maybe a little bit more. That's not everything, but it's more money in the city's pocket to go towards education and civic projects. I think job training needs to continue to be a focus. So if you are in one of these cities where steel or manufacturing, where that was the industry and people lived around the factory and there was kind of this social construct where the community supported the business and vice versa, that's a lot harder with hospitals where, again, the doctors and nurses who work there may be commuting in from far, far away. If there is a better program or a very, very strong commitment to not just get people in, but to be tolerant of the folks, and I heard a lot of this, people who would get hired from the community and fired a week later because they just weren't good cultural fits, it can be hard overnight to transform yourself into a model employee. And it seems like some of these big institutions could be a little bit more generous and a little bit more creative, not just shunting people into janitorial work, but finding those tracks to really get people from the neighborhood to the front office, too.
We were talking earlier in the program about the high maternal death rate in the United States. It's the highest in the developed world. And one of the issues was where you lived. And the two places that really stuck out was rural and urban poor areas. And the point was made that you could be living right next door to a world-class hospital, but if you can't afford to go there or if your health care coverage doesn't get you that continuity of care that you need that's so important when you're pregnant, it doesn't matter.
That's right. And we had a scoop yesterday. I scooped that Cleveland Clinic and CareSource, the biggest Medicaid managed care plan in Ohio, had severed their relationship, which meant tens of thousands of Medicaid patients aren't going to be able to access the Cleveland Clinic anymore.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, that's big and that's real. And that's, yet again, if the clinic is connected to the community, what does it mean if tens of thousands of relatively low-income folks aren't able to go there? So you also asked, Anne, about the fear earlier between the clinic and the community and why the community's nervous. I think these big academic medical centers, sometimes the procedures that they prioritize or the staff that they have working might be young residents, might be these complex procedures. And if you're going into the clinic with a relatively normal condition or you're in the backyard and you become the subject of one of their studies, it doesn't always feel like you're being prioritized over the bigger mission of the clinic to, as they did recently, to do a face transplant, which is wonderful. But the normal kind of day-to-day commodity work of healthcare doesn't always fit in.
We're just about out of time, but I thought it was interesting you brought up Johns Hopkins in Baltimore because Johns Hopkins is at the center of all the controversy about Henrietta Lacks and the HeLa cancer human cells that were used for so much research. And she was in the shadow of Johns Hopkins, was destitutely poor and never benefited from the fact that her cells helped save, well, who knows how many lives at this point.
It's a story all around the country, communities, hospitals, and what comes next for them.
Dan Diamond, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure, Anne. Thank you.
Dan Diamond is a healthcare reporter for Politico. He recently wrote about the disparity between the Cleveland Clinic and the community surrounding it. If you want to check out that article, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.